You're listening to the Nate Lull Podcast. Download each new episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And now, here's Nate.
Welcome back, my podcast friends. Today is episode 154, right here on the Nate Lull Podcast. Of course, I am your host, Nate Lull. Today is a father-son duo. Always exciting when we get family members in here together, whether it be sisters, brothers. We've had moms and daughters, and now fathers and sons. It's a lot of fun. And today, of course, on 154, we have Steve Hornung and Scott Hornung. They are a father-son duo that both coach soccer in the Tri-Valley. Of course, Steve coaches the very successful Skenivis girls team that just won Section 4 Class D and went on to the state tournament. And Scott is an assistant with Unitigo, and that's that combined Franklin-Unitigo program. They won the Tri-Valley this year. They were up in Class C and eventually lost to Green, who went on to be the Section 4 champions in Class C. So both teams had really good seasons. And as I was talking to Steve one day, he brought up some history that I want to throw out there to our listeners. We'll talk about that during the interview today to see if what we're thinking might be true is actually true. So, of course, all these guys I've known for a long time through the running community as well. We all run marathons and local races, so it was fun to chat with them about that as well. So stay tuned. This is going to be a very fun episode today. Before we jump in, of course, we want to thank all our special sponsors here on the Nate Lull Podcast. They include NYCM Insurance of Edmiston, Cohen and Fraser Builders of Franklin and Unadilla, Morabito Energy Products, Superior Heating and Air Duct Cleaning of Sydney, Gavin's Pizzeria of Sydney, DTC Delhi Telephone Company, NBT Insurance Agency, Spike's Pizza and Grocery of Edmiston, Quality Hardwoods in Twin Valley Finish Lumber, Oleout Creek Golf Course in Franklin, Acco Brands of Sydney, McCready Motors in Norwich, the Rinker Insurance Agency of Afton, Waste Recovery Enterprises of Sydney, New York Pizzeria of New Berlin, the Delaware National Bank of Delhi, Certified Financial Planner Ed Curley, Clark Sports Center of Cooperstown, Certified Auto Outlet of Oneonta, Circle of Life Ambulette of Hobart, Morabito Gresham Insurance, Huff Ice Cream of Sydney, the Franklin Railroad Museum, Benson Agency Real Estate of Oneonta, the Leather Stocking Group of Cooperstown, your registered mortgage brokers. We have SFCU, Sportsfield Specialties of Delhi, the Amphenol Corporation of Sydney, Preferred Mutual Insurance Company of New Berlin, Shindello Federal Credit Union of Franklin, and Shenango Memorial Hospital of Norwich. Episode 154 today. Grab your popcorn, sit back, relax. It'll be a good one here on the Nate Lull Podcast. Thanks, everybody. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Today is episode 154 here on the Nate Lull Podcast. Can't believe we've had that many of these, but excited for today's guest, a father-son duo. I should say guests, as we have Steve and Scott Hornung here in the studio. Sydney guys, but also soccer guys from all over. And we have some history to talk today. Of course, Steve coaches girls soccer at Skenivis, and Scott is with Franklin Unitigo and also does a lot of track stuff. So guys, thank you so much for coming to the studio.
Thank you.
Well, we're happy to be here.
So Steve, let me start with you. I was curious, and I asked you this when you came in today, but if you had ever been to the CDO studios before, I mean, does it kind of take you back to your Sydney days to be back here at 75 Main Street?
Absolutely. I was here a few times. Greg Davey did a lot to promote the station and promote sports in the local area. And he used to have radio broadcasts, and he used to do Players of the Game, Players of the Week, and things like that. And I recall that I was on with him a couple of times for various things.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into all the Sydney years, but I thought I would start with both of you guys. And, you know, this is something we started talking about one day on the sidelines, Steve, is that, you know, you guys both coach in the Tri-Valley right now. And I don't know, I'm going to throw it out to our guests. Someone can prove us wrong, but when was the last time, if ever, there was a father-son duo that both won championships in the Tri-Valley at any time for soccer. I mean, can you think of any other time, Steve, in your long soccer history?
I've been following local sports, but I haven't followed the Tri-Valley that carefully. But to my knowledge, I don't think so. And we did have the fortune of winning it on the same day, too. It wasn't just that we each won. We won on the same day on the same fields.
Now, speaking of that day, that was some of the craziest weather I think I've ever seen. Scott, for you, I felt like your boys played at probably the worst weather time of the day, that 1 o'clock spot. What was it like for you? What were you telling your guys out there during that weather?
Well, a number of things went through our mind even before the game started. The first thing was, are we going to actually end up playing? We'd gotten news from other people that were down in Binghamton that they had spotted lightning, and we were just like, okay, are we going to get this in? And one of the things that we pressed with the kids was, okay, we're going against a good team, but we're also going against the weather here. So you better step out there and be ready to go in that first half, because at any time, Mother Nature could throw some lightning down and the game could be over. So don't play like you got the full 80. Play to win right away.
So you were really thinking if we could have the lead by half, that's all we might get in.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things where you want to take everything to account, and that was one thing that we were definitely thinking about.
Have either of you guys seen a game, you know, before or since that had weather like that? I mean, that for me, that was probably one of the craziest weather games I've ever seen. I mean, Scott, for you, have you ever been involved in a game like that?
Personally, I'm thinking back to like even my youth years. I want to say there was one game where I recall maybe like 12 years old where it was downpouring the whole time, but not to that level, not with that wind, and not for such an important game either. So pretty much that full first half, we were just getting hammered by rain, and it was one of those things where in my mind, I was thinking if I was playing, I don't know whether this would be fun or whether it'd be miserable, because it is kind of fun to play in the rain a little bit, slide around, but in that kind of situation with so much on the line, in my mind, I'd probably not want that to happen.
I mean, it was just one of those times where I agree, playing in the rain is fun, but it was like the guys' uniforms were so wet. It's like that stick to your skin wet. And I was just like, everything has to, your cleats have just got to be completely washed out, soggy. I also think we were so lucky that those games were on that field, like that they handled the rain and all the wetness pretty well. I mean, you were right there on the sideline. Did you feel like the fields held up pretty well?
For the most part, the fields held up. There were, later on in the game, there were some times where you could see the players just struggling with footing. But fortunately enough, that did not come into play in terms of like a deciding factor in the game. So there was never a situation where a player lost their footing and that led to the winning goal or anything like that, which in my mind would be kind of cheap. It was played straight up.
I really got thinking about this weekend because I went down to States and I got to watch the Courtright boys play in their state semifinal, and they had to play on grass Saturday morning at 9:15 in the morning, and the field just couldn't handle it. It was absolutely chewed up. A ball would come down and just stick in the mud. There was no bounce. Guys were slipping and sliding. I really thought it affected the game, and I just think we're so lucky to have those fields in Oneonta. So, you know, Steve, for you, the weather, if I'm remembering correctly, was a little better by the time the girls played?
The weather was 100% better. The hardest part of that day for me was watching Scott's game. We got there to watch the second half, and as his game unfolded, you could see the end of the worst of the weather. And by the time our game started, we actually had to change to a different field because his field was pretty beat up, especially on the sidelines because it's crowned. But then we did go to a different field and there was not standing water on the field. And the weather actually cleared up quite nicely for us. So it was really nice. I'm glad we played it on that day because we wouldn't have had difficulty making it up with the sectionals coming up.
Yeah. So, you know, for your Skenevis girls, I felt like they've been so close the last couple of years to getting a league title. You know, oftentimes they'd be a one seed in the playoffs and either get upset somewhere along the way, and just felt like they were climbing that mountain. And this year they get over it and win the Tri-Valley. How did that feel for the girls and for you?
Well, it felt really nice for the girls, the parents, the fans, everybody in the school. I've been there about 3 years now, and we're going through tough times, as everybody knows. And I was able to witness what you had just described, the frustrations on the soccer field. The first year I was there, they had a quality team, and they had two key injuries near the end of the season. They lost their goalie. And whenever you lose your goalie, it always impacts another factor on the field, and you always have to steal from another position. So now you're hurting two positions. And they also lost their top scorer. Angie got hurt in the sectionals. So in both instances, they were playing without 100% of their roster 2 years ago. And then last year, I did have the opportunity to coach in the spring season, but because of COVID, we could only play a limited schedule. And we really had a nice team again last year. Mm-hmm. We had three seniors that were making great contributions last year, Hannah Osborne and Autumn Jones. And then I had Katie Hogue, who was our backup keeper, who really helped us out in a lot of ways. And it's too bad that those girls didn't have a chance to continue, because we had quite a good season going last year in the short little period that we had. So, yeah, there was a sense of frustration, and it hung in the air. And I'm very, very happy that we overcame those obstacles. It was frustrating, and the girls did feel a lot of pressure. And luckily, we were able to come through and stay healthy this year, and COVID didn't get in the way. At this time, though, I want to mention that I did have somebody else working with me, and that was Tim Smith. And it's really nice to have another coach working 50-50 with you, because Tim and I were able to break down the practice sessions. He was able to specialize and work with the goalies. And he actually started working with me last year. I saw that he was knowledgeable in the sport last year, and I asked him to come help our goalies, and he did. And I said, hey, this guy is really good. Let's try to keep him around. So we worked it out. And it was a real nice way of being able to help the kids get prepared, because we had two sets of eyes and two sets of different ideas. So it really did work out.
And you can really see with Tim his passion for the game and just a great local sports guy in general. I know he helps out with some Catskill Mountain AAU stuff, I believe, and just a really great guy to have around. And, you know, Scott, for you, getting to work with Alicia Lang over at Franklin, that seems like it's been another good pairing to have two coaches together. I mean, Alicia has been around for a long time and certainly knows the goalie position very well. What's it been like working with her at Franklin?
Well, the best thing is she knows so much about soccer that when I came over, it was just like she knew more than like I could even dream about knowing. And she is great at planning out practice sessions, and she is great at like identifying players and the skills that might not show up immediately. And in the long run, she is putting them in the perfect position. And when we first started coaching together, I didn't really know how it was going to work out, because it was kind of a late decision. We struggled with numbers a couple of years ago. They'd struggled with numbers, and it was like, hey, we combine in other sports for some things. Let's give it a try. And I originally thought that Alicia was just going to be the head coach because she had quite a bit more year seniority than me. And then my superintendent, Dave Richards, said, hey, we'd like a representative there. We want you to be there. And I said, sure, I'll do it. But going in, I didn't like really know what my role was going to be. And I think our roles over the last 3 years, it's kind of worked out on its own. She's realized, okay, this is stuff I should take care of. I've kind of realized this is stuff I should take care of. And it hasn't really been something where we sat down and did it. And I think we've just both coached so long that we just kind of figured out where we best fit and where we could best give advice as time went on.
I wanted to get the story from you, because a common question that I get from many Tri-Valley fans is, you know, why did Franklin go with Unitigo? And I think the perception, at least when it started, was that Franklin needed Unitigo, which, if I'm remembering correctly, was more the other way around. Am I right?
The last three seasons, it's almost been exactly equal. We've had just enough where we probably could not safely have a team. There was one year, I believe, we had 9, and another we had 10. And this year we had about the same. And it could have been, we'll give it a try and we'll hope to pull someone in, maybe hope we don't have injuries.
Right.
And they were pretty much in the exact same boat. And joining and coming together, it's really helped out both schools. And the kids had gelled and basically became close friends so quickly. I think that helped immensely, that we just came together and there was not really a getting used to each other period. And like I said before, we combined in a couple other sports. Last year, baseball combined, both varsity and JV. In the past, football is combined. So it wasn't really a crazy outside the box idea. It's something that we had done in other sports before. We're right over the mountain. It's not too far of a trip. So it just worked out perfectly at the perfect time for filling both schools' needs.
Am I correct? The first year, it was like you guys only had like three guys. Is that right?
It was a little bit more than that. This year was a little bit more even in terms of the amount of players. The first year, we had less. And then as the years have gone on, it's kind of evened out.
The other question I always get is, you know, Unitigo, this is a small school perception thing, I think. Unitigo is a big C school. How can they not have enough guys? I mean, you're inside the building every day. Is it a low boys class numbers thing?
It's just a random thing. Yeah. There are some kids that want to do sports. There are some kids that would prefer to do other things, and it just worked out time-wise. Last couple of years, other kids would prefer to do other things, and that's just the way it happened. And just numbers-wise, I graduated from Sydney about 20 years ago. Schools around this area were much larger back then in terms of student population. Mm-hmm. So comparing my experiences in school to Unitigo and working there, the classes are much, much smaller nowadays. And you can kind of see it in a lot of other districts. Some other teams combined Lawrence and Milford in the league. And it's also in other sports teams or schools are combining. So it's not really one of those things where it's like, oh, you're Class C, you have tons of people. We're a small Class C.
Oh, yeah.
And if a few kids don't come out, we are in some numbers trouble. So that is more how I look at it rather than why don't you find people that maybe are not ready to play or don't really want to.
I totally agree, and I want to come back to this conversation for various reasons. But, you know, Steve, to throw it back to you, when I first started covering Angie, you know, in seventh grade, she had Scott as a coach, Wolstenholme, and then there was, I think, one other coach, and then you?
Yeah, the other coach was Paris
right.
DiMatteo. I think that's how you say her name. And she played at Del High, and she's very knowledgeable. And prior to that, she had Scott, and Scott had coached the boys for a while. So then she's had Tim and I, and so that's been the sequence for Angie and Taylor Knapp.
Right, right. I guess what I'm getting at here is I had Ange in here for a podcast, and I said, well, you know, Paris is leaving. I heard, who's your new coach? And she said, you. I didn't even know that you were teaching there at the time. So I was wondering your journey on getting to Skenevis. I thought you had retired from Sydney. I wasn't sure quite what the timeline was.
Well, I did retire from Sydney a few years ago, and I had then worked a couple of fill-in positions at Sydney. People apparently are leaving the profession at times now. And a couple years ago, I got a phone call a couple days before school started, and Kim Matthews was on the other end. She's the principal at Skenevis. And she asked me if I was interested in a job, and I said no. And then she said, please just come in and visit. And I did. And I saw wonderful things in that school just in my short little visit. The kids are just fantastic kids up and down the line. So I said to Kim, okay, I'll do this for a year. And then Teresa Carlin, who's the superintendent, I had her children in Sydney too. And she asked me a couple months into the school year if I could stay 2 more years because of the merger. And I said, yeah, I think maybe. We'll play it 1 year at a time. And so here it is. This is the third year. And I told Teresa that I wouldn't mind coaching soccer, especially when I saw the girls. I think a fool would you'd have to be a fool to turn that down.
Yeah.
So I ended up coaching the girls last spring in the shortened season, and then this year, and then next year we'll see. We have to see how those votes go and things like that, and we'll see how the cards are dealt. But it's been a good decision for me. It's been a good decision in many, many ways. The girls are phenomenal in terms of not only their playing abilities, but they're phenomenal people. They're very responsible. They take care of picking up the equipment without me asking. It's all those little things that coaches really appreciate that I get from the girls. And I'm not talking about one or two players. I'm talking about every kid that puts the uniform on. There's a lot of pride in the school, and rightfully so. And once they got me there, they kind of hooked me. And it's very, very, very difficult to think about leaving because it's such a great place to be.
I have to concur. I think your group is a really special, fantastic group of kids. And Scott, the same for your guys. I get to travel all over and see all these schools, and our whole area is really blessed with just really fantastic kids. But your Skenivis group is really a nice group of kids. So I guess it's an unfair question to you, but you really don't know what the future holds, right? We don't know about the merger. We don't know any of those things.
I don't know about what the future holds, nor does anybody else in the school, but I will say this. Whatever happens, we'll make the best of it. If we merge with Worcester, I got some really good vibrations from the kids from Worcester. Last year, I filled in for the track coach for a day or two because she had to be at an appointment. And the Worcester kids, of course, have merged with the Skenivis kids in track. And they're wonderful kids that came over, and I enjoyed working with them in the short period of time. And they've been very, very good sportsmen in our games. I enjoyed coaching with Jim Kenyon. And I really think that if the merger comes along, I think it's going to work out very well. If the merger doesn't come along, I work with a lot of dedicated people. I think there's a lot of commitment in the district from all the staff. I think the parents want to see this succeed. The kids want to see this succeed. So if that's the hand we're dealt, that's the hand we'll play, and we'll make the best of it.
You know, being a Tri-Valley guy myself, going to GMU, I totally understand the concerns of merging and losing your school identity and all those things. But having seen Skenivis and Worcester together for track and seeing them support each other at big games, not uncommon to see Worcester kids supporting your girls in the soccer season and vice versa. I feel like the kids, if this does happen, it will be a great relationship, much like Unitego and Franklin. Just seems like they're already friends. It's not like this old school rivalry, beat 'em up type of thing, right? I mean, it already seems like they're very good friends.
They are. And a couple of years ago, we had a play that the kids put on together, and it was a phenomenal performance. They did a musical. There were dance numbers in it. And we're talking about two small D schools. We're looking at maybe 60 total kids in a class, and they put on this wow of a performance. And if that's an indication of what those two schools can do when they work together, they can do a lot in a lot of other areas.
I was just talking to the Odell family from Worcester about that show, and they said they did, I think, a performance in Worcester, and then they packed everything up and did a performance in Skenivis. And I'm thinking, wow, that's a lot to move and do, but it just showed the dedication. I love it. Scott, of course, I want to go back to Franklin and Unitego, the group of guys that you had, much like Skenivis, great group. Let's talk Matt Cerro and some of those Franklin guys that just kind of seem to be your leaders this year on paper, but also the Unitego guys that came over. I mean, I would say on paper, maybe Matt gets the headlines a lot of the time because he finishes a lot of those goals, but it felt like you had a lot of guys step up from all over the place this year.
Yeah, and really the way I look at it is I look at the last 3 years and how we've kind of grown together as starting off as two separate teams coming together to become really just one team. And I really noticed it this year that it seemed like we had certain kids come from Unitego that took care of certain positions, and Franklin had certain kids that took care of certain positions. And it was just one of those things where we had what we needed in one area, they had what we needed in another area, and it just worked out perfectly that way. So the vast majority of our defense were Unitego kids. Mm-hmm. And I think when you do look at the box scores, you see a lot of Franklin names in there. That's because most of the midfielders and forwards were Franklin kids. So we had three kids that played defense, David Clapper, Xander Johnson, who was an eighth grader. And if you watched him play, you would definitely not assume that he was an eighth grader. And Braden Nichols, who played varsity for the first time this year as a ninth grader. And combined experience-wise, two of those kids, this is their first varsity year. David, he played a partial season last year. And they came in this year, and they did an awesome job. And then other defenders, you have Connor Culp, who played in the outside. He was a Franklin kid, and he was more the older person in that backfield. He was a senior, so he had the experience, and I think from time to time he was a good leader back there, but it wasn't one of those, like, I'm yelling at people type leadership. I saw him talk to the younger players quite a bit, so that worked out nicely. And when you talk about Matt Cerro and Brandon Gregory, in terms of leadership, they are outstanding leaders. And it is the positive reinforcement type leadership that they provide. And I think when you have a lot of young kids like we had in our team this year, a lot of freshmen, eighth grader, couple of 10th graders, kids who've not played a lot of varsity, when they have that positive leadership, they are more likely to do well in the long run rather than older people yelling at them and getting down and stuff like that. So just the way the teams fitted in together, it worked out really great this year.
Getting a chance to play in the C sectionals is something new for Franklin guys, mm-hmm. but maybe not soccer-wise, but getting a chance to go up and play Green. You gave them a good game, had to play on the turf, which is new for you guys. And, you know, Green goes on to upset Lansing and win Section 4. And honestly, I mean, they were one breakaway goal away from going to the state Final Four. I mean, that game with Cooperstown could have gone either way. You had to be proud of your guys for that effort, I would say, right?
Yeah, and really the way that we looked at it is going into sectionals throughout my playing and previous coaching career, it had always been Class C. And you kind of get a general like sense of where you need to be at. And I felt that when we went in, we were right there.
Yeah.
So it wasn't one of those where, okay, we're a small C combined with a really small D school. Hopefully we do well and don't like embarrass ourselves. It was, we're going to go out there. We're going to compete. And the way that it worked out is since we played in the Tri-Valley and played so many D schools, we did not have a lot of sectional points going in. So I really looked at us as kind of a, like, hidden, dangerous, lower seed type school. And we took care of business and came out and made a nice statement in the first round against Newark Valley.
That was huge.
And I think just, like, in terms of getting them prepared for the next game, I think that helped a great deal. And Green definitely had a really, really good team. And Rick Tallman has done a great job with that program. And while we were there playing, I felt that at any moment, we could, once we went down a little ways in the second half by one goal, I felt that at any moment we could just be right back in there. And it, the way it worked out is Green played great defensively. Their plan for us, they did a great job of stopping us from getting opportunities. And it wasn't one of those games where it was just like, oh, they dominated. It was, we had our chances, they had their chances, and they just ended up making more from their chances.
Yeah, when I talked to Rick afterwards, and I have a lot of respect for him and what he's done over there, just puts in so much time with those guys. He spoke very highly of you guys. And I think your win over Newark Valley surprised a lot of maybe bigger school C people, because I did get a couple of texts that night being like, whoa, what's up with that Franklin Unitego score?
Yeah, and I think it's just one of those things where we were pretty much all, except for maybe two games, Tri-Valley games.
Yeah.
And if you don't play outside of your league a lot, you kind of are uncertain as to, okay, here are the scores over here, here are the scores on our side. We don't know whether these match up or anything like that. So I was kind of interested to see, okay, stepping in and playing against a MAC school, where the levels are at, and they're pretty much right together.
Yeah. Switching back to Skenevis for a minute here, Steve, I would say arguably, from an outsider's perspective, you have such a huge collection of talent on your team. And it's not just one or two players. I mean, it's five, six, seven, eight players that are all household names, plus the other players as well that are very, very good. But when you have players like Ange and Taylor Knapp and Lily and Sam Osborne, and the list goes on, Liana Darling, an amazing defender, was it, you know, you said you wanted to get into coaching, but was it almost intimidating? Like, there's a lot of firepower here. What do I do with it?
No, it wasn't intimidating at all. If you've coached, you get opportunities rarely to have a collection of talent like that. And you can't pass it up. I mean, it's just, I could see they were talented from when I watched them from the sidelines when they were younger players. Scott probably remembers this, but the first night I had practice last spring, I spoke with him about how the practice went, and I was just giddy with what I saw. I told him that they are a very special, talented group, and I also told him that they were very deep. And that's the one thing that I think really was one of our strengths. Angie's a star. Taylor's a star. Lily's a star. All three of them are just phenomenal players. They put a lot of time in. The dedication is off the charts. They score a lot of goals, and sometimes the other kids kind of get missed. And kids like Kaylee Bryant, mm-hmm. Leanna Darling, Amber Wyckoff, who made a great, great play in one of the games against Franklin. I think it was the sectional game. where she slid on the goal line and kept the ball from going in.
Yeah, yeah.
Kids like that who don't score goals sometimes can get missed by a lot of people, except, of course, for the coaches that are standing on the sideline. And they make a big contribution. So you're right. We were very, very deep. It was really nice to have that depth. But one of the biggest frustrations this year was that there were so many teams that we played early on that were overmatched that we really couldn't let loose. And we did move a lot of people in and out of the lineup, and we moved a lot of people around. And I think, you know, in the end, that might not have been the best formula for us when we got into the state tournament and stuff. I believe we could have won a state championship.
I agree.
I think we could have won the Poland game had a play gone one way or another. It didn't happen that way. But in no way, shape, or form were we not capable of winning state championship this year. And sometimes it's those things that build up collectively that might be that one little piece. And it was too bad that we couldn't have gotten some different schools on our non-league schedule. But it was kind of difficult to build that non-league schedule. People are tight, and
exactly.
They don't always want to play a D school.
Mm-hmm.
They have very little to gain by playing a D school if you're a bigger school. So I understand that, but I don't think that helped us in the long run.
That's well said. Oftentimes people say, well, why don't they just go play some bigger schools? It's not always easy to get those bigger schools to play you. But you brought up the Poland game. You lose 4-3 in the state quarterfinals. Like you said, you play that team. I think you said it to me that night. You play that team 10 times. You win 5. They win 5. I mean, great game. They go on and win their state semi 7-0. And then they do fall in the championship game, which is a different conversation. I do have a question for you about that. But so you guys were very, very capable. But how has the group handled the loss to Poland? Is it still stinging?
It stings. It's going to sting probably until the day we all die. You know, if you're a committed athlete and a committed coach, you don't ever get rid of those stings. We move on and we look at what's next, but that lingers, especially when you know that you were capable of beating that team. Had we lost 5-0, then I think we would have been able to walk away a little differently. I don't think it would have been easier. It would have been different. The Poland team was a team that our kids had a lot of respect for. And so in some ways, when you lose to a team like that, I think in the long run, you say to yourselves, you know, they're very good, and give them credit. And I think my girls have taken that approach to give the other teams credit. And I think there were maybe one or two other teams that were playing at that level in the state, but I certainly feel that we were among the top four. And any of those four teams could have won a state championship.
Yeah, I mean, Poland is just a dynamite program, and they've won many state championships. They were the defending state champs from 2019. This is a 100% completely unfair question to ask you. So Poland goes on and they lose to Mount Academy. I think it was 3-1 in the state finals. Mount Academy boys and girls both win the state title. And there's been a lot of crying out this week by fans saying, and Scott, we could get your opinion on this as well, why should D schools have to play a quote-unquote private school? They're much like a Seton Catholic type of school in the States. I mean, if Skenevis had gotten there, do you have a feeling on that? I mean, I'm very torn.
Yeah,
on
I do have a feeling, and I'm not afraid to give my opinion on this sort of thing. First of all, the score was 3-2, so Poland was right there. Yeah, it was 3-2. And at one time, I think it was 2-2, so it was never 3-1 or 3-0.
Right.
I really think that we have to be very, very careful with private schools, because public schools have to follow certain rules that private schools don't have to follow. If we have one player that lives 15 feet over our district line that comes to us and wants to come to our school, we have to jump through hoops.
Mm-hmm.
But any private school can take any player at any time. So right away, you've got that discrepancy right there. And the other thing about Mount Academy, and I don't know if it's true on the girls' side, but I read that the boys don't even have to win a sectional title. So, and they've been in the state playoffs. I'm talking about the boys' team.
Right.
Four of the five last times. Here's a team that doesn't even have to go through the process in Section 9. They're the only D school, so they're automatically in the state tournament. And I think that's somewhat of an advantage because then they can key their whole schedule to playing bigger schools, and they have multiple advantages. So of the people that are contacting you, I see what they're saying. You know, there's a little bit of unfairness in that. And I think, you know, that Poland is the big loser on that right now.
Yeah, I felt bad for Poland, for sure. On the boys' side, I felt bad because I felt bad for various teams. In the past, the Mount Academy boys teams were on a completely different level. As Bob Van said to me, the SK coach, when they played them in 2017, he goes, we didn't even belong on the same field as them. They were that good. This year, I felt they were beatable. But still, to have some of the, their advantages to getting to the state tournament, yeah, it leaves a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that question because when I was coaching in Sydney, the one time that we did go to the state tournament, we ended up playing Christian Brothers Academy from Syracuse. Mm. And
yeah, tell me about this.
I think there were 5 or 6 D1 players at Christian Brothers Academy. And the similarities are really, really eerie. We scored 31 seconds into the game against Poland. My boys scored 9 seconds into the game against CBA. So I've gone to 2 state quarterfinals, and both my teams have scored in the first half minute of the game. And both my teams ended up not winning with the boys in Sydney, and it was in 94. We had a 1-0 lead until 2 minutes to go, and then they scored. And Scott remembers it well because he was ball boying on the side, and we thought the kid was offsides, and
no, he definitely was. Yeah.
The video showed that he was, and when he got to college, he was in the same dorm with Rob Monroe at Virginia Tech, and the first thing he told Rob Monroe was that he was offsides. But that's besides the point. We lost in shootout to Christian Brothers, and you know there's it's the same thing that I said before. It's not the same thing. It's an apple and an orange, and you know CBA is. Put out some fantastic teams in not just soccer, but in a lot of different sports, D1 athletes, and it's just not the same.
I can agree. When I was playing at GMU, we would go to the Oxford tournament. And we were the smallest school there, and it was Oxford, GMU, Green, and they, for some reason, they would invite Manlius Pebble Hill, who was a private school and was doing very, very well in Section 3, Class D at that time. I believe made a couple of state Final Fours, if not the final, if not winning 1 or 2. And I was always like, how can this be a D team, you know? So thank you for weighing in on that that conversation.
Not afraid to weigh in.
Scott, for you, this is one question I had. Getting to grow up watching your dad coach, I'm assuming getting to play for your dad.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, what was that experience like? You see a lot of father-son duos, but this one has just lasted the test of time. I mean, between ball boy, player, now you're both coaches. It's really cool.
Oh, I really don't see it as like out of the ordinary. It was just what I did growing up. So it seemed very normal for me. I will say, and he's mentioned it a couple times, as a coach, if you're coaching your kids, it's a little different. And I think playing for your father, it's not quite to the same level. But I know he did not provide any favoritism to me. And I specifically remember why, because when I was in 9th grade playing in the Mang tournament, I was on the varsity, scored 2 goals in the first game of the Mang tournament, played quite a bit in the second game, and then ended up getting sent to the JV shortly thereafter.
Oh,
so
boy.
that's one thing that stuck in my mind, and I can understand why that team had a lot of much older players that would get a lot more minutes than me. But really, it's just been part of my life, and I haven't really thought twice about it. And then when I had a chance to coach, it just seemed natural, and I just stepped in and did it. And I will say I don't try to emulate him when I coach or anything like that. I try to do my own style. I don't know from the sideline whether parents see that or players see that as similar or different if they've seen both of us coach. So I'll kind of leave it up to them on that.
Do you guys call each other after games, bounce things off each other at all?
Every once in a while. It's not one of those everyday things. It's sometimes we have done it like beginning of the season. Like, hey, what are some good drills? What are you thinking of this? What are you thinking of that? And as the season goes on, we kind of check in terms of, okay, how'd your team play? Oh, I saw you didn't score too many in this game. What happened? One of those deals. But it's not an every night type deal.
Do you have a favorite memory playing for your dad?
I think surprisingly, it's going to be a game that we lost. When I was a junior, we were playing against Oneana in the, at that point, the very last SUS League Championship. And playing against Oneana that year was the year prior, or the year prior to that year, they came off their state championship run where they pretty much wiped out everyone.
Right.
And playing that year against them, I can remember he as a coach and the rest of my teammates, we were really hyped up to kind of go out there and beat them. And when we played them in the regular season, we did end up beating them the first game. And then we ended up playing them in the league championship, ended up losing like in sudden death overtime. And I think just him getting us to that level where we are like grinding it out against a quality team like that, even if we didn't come up winning, it shows that he as a coach, us as players, we are ready to step up to that level and challenge anyone.
Steve, what was it like coaching in the SUS, in the gauntlet that was the SUS? I mean, that must have just been so
It was
awesome.
A wonderful experience. And, you know, you mentioned Rick Tallman before. I got a chance to coach against some really great coaches, Rick being one of them, Bill Case before him at Green. Made friendships. In fact, before the sectional finals, Rick came over and wished us luck. And after the game was over, I went looking for Rick, but he was still involved in the overtime. Coaching against Alex Brandon was wonderful. I consider him to be just an outstanding coach, a coach that can teach a lot of people a lot of things. I feel fortunate that we were able to play with Oneana because when we went through our league schedule, it was real easy to get the kids ready for sectionals because we had seen what we consider to be one of the top programs in the state year after year. And we did beat them three times. And I don't know if many local teams have beaten Oneana in boys soccer three times, but in the course of the times that we played them, we were fortunate to end up with three victories. They beat us a lot of times too, and they spanked us a lot of times too, but it was never a situation where we looked at it negatively. It was too bad that Oneana didn't continue as a member of the SUS MAC. I think the league was stronger as a result of them being with us. And I think we lost a lot when they left. And it's a sad thing because those kids are great players over there. The coaches are great. And it was all good for our whole league to have that. So, yeah, and Scott did remember that game. And that was a quadruple overtime. I remember we didn't really have a set a sequence that we were going to follow after we got through the first two overtimes. The refs didn't know, and Alex and I, we just looked at each other, and we both believed that we should play it out, and even though we lost, and I'll say this, I'm very glad we played it out.
I love not going to kicks if you don't have to.
Right.
I love it.
Well, we were going to declare a co-championship, but we decided we wanted to play it on the field.
Yeah.
And I think even though one team wins and one team loses, I think many, many years down the road, I think we're happy we did that. I think, as Scott said, I think it's a memory that we take into the future, and it's a positive memory, even though it's a loss.
I know I've watched some recent Tri-Valley championships where they don't even play overtime. They just immediately declare co-champs, and it just – I felt like both teams walked away kind of with a stale taste in their mouth, and I love that you guys played it out. That's really
– It was good.
Tell me about – your 94 team. I don't know much about this team. I've heard a little bit, but it sounds like it was a phenomenal group.
The 94 team was very, very strong. We were a very strong defensive team. We had a great goalie. He still lives in Bainbridge, Jason Ruff, and he was a big, tall, 6'2", 6'3 kid, could get up, get the high ball, and ended up being a really good basketball player and was a great athlete. But we had great athletes all over. Robbie Monroe played a defensive position for us, and Tommy Dutcher, who played D2 at Francis Marion University in South Carolina, was our top scorer. And Andy Bagley was the kid with the dirtiest uniform. And Travis Smith, who was a phenomenal athlete, a kid who played on three sectional championships that year because he was a baseball player. And I know he was a winter sport athlete, but I can't remember what it was. But he had multiple sectional championships that year. We were just very, very good. Nick Brandt played on the left side. Mike Doy played on, those are old-time Sydney names. They go way back.
Oh, yeah.
Steve Donaldson was the player of the year, the Daily Star player of the year. He played sweeper back for us, and Brendan Armour played. We had a really talented team. I think we had about 20 players, and it was one of those teams where I could go deep into the bench and get something out of every kid. And that's always the best season. Whenever you can get a contribution that's meaningful from every player on your team, and the kids know it. I think when the season's over, they look back and they say, that was really nice. And that was a really nice thing. We lost to Oneana over there. I think it was 3-1. And then they came back and we played under the lights. And I think Greg did the broadcast. And Rusty Nichols was the color guy.
Rusty. Oh, I love
and,
Rusty.
We beat Oneana. And that was the first time they'd ever lost to a team in a Sus at that time. And I don't think many other teams beat them except for us. Maybe Green beat them, but I don't recall that. But we had a mob of people at Keith Clark Park under the lights. I think there were 500 or 600 people down there. It had to have been one of the biggest attended soccer games in the whole region. It was just phenomenal. It was just a wonderful night.
I would like both of your takes on this. And, you know, Scott, we could start with you. I really miss games at Keith Clark Park, and I didn't know many of them. But I can remember GMU did play in the Mang tournament a few times before I started playing, and we would come down. You know, I was in modified maybe. It was probably late 90s when they were just finishing that tournament up, at least for GMU going there, I mean. But I just remember thinking this was so cool. Under the lights down there, it just seemed like a really cool atmosphere. You know, Scott, what do you remember from those days?
I remember good times down there. And we kind of... When I was playing in Sydney, had a slight home field advantage at Keith Clark Park because as the season wore on, with us playing there, with football playing there, with youth football playing there, the field got kind of tore up, and we were used to playing on it. It was kind of like a moonscape, holes here, no grass in this half of the field. And we got up quite a bit for those night games. They were something special for all of us. And the nice thing was that we had quite a few of them, so it wasn't one of those you get one per year and then you're done.
Right.
We got quite a few, which the Village of Sydney was really helpful with. I do remember some, because the field is so close to the river, some somewhat eerie games. I don't remember whether it was a sectional game or a Sus playoff game, but I think it was my junior year, and we were playing against Bainbridge. And I don't know what was going on with the weather, but... Off the river, just this huge layer of fog just rolled on in. And it was so thick that from standing on midfield, you could not see the goal in front of you.
Oh, my God.
And we played a good half of the game like that, unable to pretty much see half your teammates. And I'm fairly certain the crowd there did not see much of the game at all, but I do remember that they stayed for the whole thing.
Wow.
So Keith Clark Park, it was a unique experience because it's a lot different than the more modern day facilities that we have.
Yeah. I mean, Coach, for you, you must have had a lot of good memories down
there. A lot of good memories. I remember that game that Scott just mentioned, but I had forgotten about it, to be honest with you. my favorite thing about Keith Clark Park, it was narrow. And we always had a lot of fast kids. And, you know, I've known Alex Brandon for years, and I see him. I haven't seen him in a while, but for a while I was seeing him regularly after he had – left and gone to the Stack League, and he would always complain to me about the narrow. His kids would turn and go wide, and there would be no wide, and the ball would go out of bounds, and he'd tear his hair out, and I would just smile, and I would say, that's a home field advantage, and it was a huge home field advantage for us because it was long and lean, and we were able to take advantage of that.
We had Alex in here for an interview, and he was phenomenal, told a lot of really good stories. I can remember being a small school kid going to the tournament. I thought it was so cool that Sydney had warm-up music for soccer at Mang. I just thought that was like the coolest thing ever. And I can remember the Sydney team like coming out of some shed in the back corner. Like they must have been putting their cleats on in there, and they ran out. And it was just like, as like a sixth or seventh grader, I was like, oh, so intimidating. Like this team was in that shed in the dark, and then they just came piling out onto the field like – it's just a cool vibe to it. I don't know. I really enjoyed watching games down there. So it's a lot different now. The turf is beautiful up here. I think it's great, but a lot different. A lot different for sure. Well, before I leave soccer talk, I wanted to talk some running while we were
here.
That's fine. Is there anything I missed? Anything you guys wanted to say? I mean, there's a lot to get through with those two programs, and both had great years.
I I just think, you know, I just want to reiterate how fortunate I was to be able to be in Sydney for as long as I was, and then to be able to coach in Skenevis. I mean, I've just been a very lucky person to be able to have those two experiences. So I just wanted to say that.
How many years total have you been at the...
28 years of coaching soccer in Sydney. Then I coached some other things, a little bit of JV softball. I coached modified basketball, boys and girls. And one year I coached JV basketball because the JV girls basketball, he had a heart attack, one of the coaches. He lived, thank goodness. And I think he's still alive, Bill Boyle. But I coached in Sydney for the soccer program 28 years, and now it's second year in Skenevis.
And Scott, for you, I know you've done soccer. You've done a bunch with indoor and outdoor track. How many years for you now?
This is my 7th year at Unitego.
Wow. Yep. And correct me if I'm wrong, do you both teach social studies?
We both do, yep.
So I guess you kind of took after your dad?
I kind of did, and it was an interesting dynamic when he started teaching at Skenevis. He was teaching a couple of grade levels that he had never taught before, which I taught, and then he was just coming to me saying, all right, give me stuff. What do you got? What should I do with this and all that? And I felt like it seemed a little off me, the younger one who was giving a bunch of stuff to the person who had been teaching quite a long time. But yeah, I followed in his footsteps in that field. That just something I'm interested in, and I enjoy doing it.
Now, 7th, 8th grade, social studies, right in that range?
So I have 7th and 9th this particular year. In the past, I've had economics, I've had government, I've had 11th graders. So I've been all over the place.
And Steve, have you just taught them all pretty much over the years?
He helped me immensely with the 7th graders. I really pretty much spent most of my career at the high school in Sydney. And 7th graders were a whole different breed.
Yeah.
And he talked me down off the cliff a couple times regarding the 7th graders. And now, you know, they're delightful. I think they're – but I had to learn, not them. They've always been the same. And I had to learn that my high school mannerisms for 7th graders might not work as well.
What is 7th grade history? Is it American history?
It's early American history, yep.
That's cool. I have always said when I was going to college, if there was one other thing I could have studied besides broadcasting, it would have been social studies, teaching history. I just think that would have been the other way for me to go. And I often wonder what that would be like. But
you can come in and try it one time.
Yeah, I don't know. I was very lucky to have Harry Papistrat at GMU. I know he's
Harry
a Sydney
for years.
Guy. Yeah. And he just made history come alive for us. He was very organized with his notes and everything, but he was so into it, and I always loved going to his class. It was great. I've known both of you guys for a long time through running, and I was laughing today, Steve, thinking about 2018 Boston, which was probably the worst weather race I've ever run, and we were huddled under a tent waiting for 2 or 3 hours for the start with Wayne Allen, and that was a crazy day. But both of you guys are big marathon runners, and I just thought I would ask both of you how you both got into that originally.
Well, I had done track for years when I was younger. And really, when I went to college, I decided I'm just doing the college thing. I'm not doing any sports. And a couple of years after college, I just was just like, I kind of miss competing and stuff like that. Yeah. And I got into it. It was something that's fairly easy to do. A lot of local races. And you can kind of make your own schedule. You could do it on your own. And really, I missed the competition, and it's back now. And the thing that's different is high school is more you're competing against other people. Now it's more you're competing against yourself and seeing how fast you can go and comparing yourself this year to last year and all that. So that's how I got back into it.
Yeah. Steve, for you?
I think I got involved when I stopped coaching soccer in Sydney. I needed something to do, and Scott was involved in running 5Ks and 10Ks. So I tagged along once or twice and got through it. It took a while to get through it. And then I started to train, and it was a gradual progression. You went from one type of race to another type of race. And then I remember one of my parents and one of my modified girls basketball players is a triathlete, and she kind of talked me into trying triathlons. And I said, well, that's pretty good. And then I retired from teaching, and I said, I need something to do. And Wayne had run a marathon first, I think before any of the three of us, Wayne Allen. And I said to myself, okay, I'm retiring. I need something to do. So I said, oh, I'm going to run in a marathon. So I picked Cape Cod, which was an October marathon. and it was a Boston qualifier, and I had no clue as to what I was doing in terms of tactics, and I went out too fast, and we always talked about this, but I was able to maintain, and I was able to beat the qualifying standard by 28 minutes, which is
quite
a nice time. But when you're older, the qualifying standards are a lot easier. And I did two Bostons, and the second one was with you. And I will forever remember that race because, you know, when you talked about the circumstances, it was – there was snow on the outside under the tent as we were getting ready to get line up for the race, and it was muddy and wet and just miserable. And then we were running – we actually were running through rivers of water. It was snowing. It was raining. It stopped. It started. It was just torrential. And it was an interesting race, but I was so glad that I got into running because I continue, although the injuries do come along when you get older. I'm cutting back. I'm not running marathons anymore, but I did two Bostons and I did three total marathons, so I think that's good enough, and I'll just stick with the shorter races right now. But it's really enjoyable. It's really enjoyable to meet people like you, Nate, because we really hadn't met, and then we started running, and then we knew Wayne, and the brotherhood and sisterhood of the runners is quite a nice thing, and we cheer for each other, and it's really a good thing to do.
And Scott, for you, how many have you done now?
Actually, this past weekend, I've did my ninth.
Did your ninth? So, so did you do two this fall?
So I did one in October, and then one, yep. And I actually, a couple of years ago, I was trying to qualify for Boston, and I did an October one. Didn't do so hot. Was kind of annoyed, and I was just like, that day, I was just like, okay, I got to find another race, and I found one in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, super flat course, and went fast, qualified for Boston. Unfortunately, COVID came along, so theoretically, last month, I should have been running in Boston, but since they cut the numbers down, I got bounced, but this past weekend, I requalified, so I should be there in 2023,
awesome.
Assuming nothing weird happens.
And I can't believe I got the email today that they are not – there's no cushion for 2022. So if you ran the qualifying time, everybody's getting in, which I just – they said it's the first time since 2013 that that's happened. I just couldn't believe it. Like I just thought, okay, you always need your time and you always need the cushion, right? And how much cushion do I need? I was shocked to see that. But I'm glad you're going to be back in 2023. That's awesome. Did you do – the virtual one for Boston?
I did not. No.
So, okay.
No, if I'm going to do a marathon, I'm doing it the full experience.
That's what I thought too. I hadn't qualified for that one. If I had qualified and it had been the time they did the virtual one, I don't know what I would have done. Mm-hmm. I just can't imagine running in my back, you know, the back roads that I run on and having it count for anything, I guess. But do you guys have a favorite that you've done?
For me, it's the Harrisburg just because I've done so well there.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about Harrisburg is the marathon starts and finishes on an island in the middle of the Susquehanna River.
Really?
And that island houses the Washington Center's minor league baseball team. So the field's there. So it's kind of cool because you get to like go around the outside of the field. And it's just like a very unique thing that you start in an island, you finish in an island. You go over a bunch of bridges. It's a good one.
I've read up on that one, but haven't done it. Going to have to add that one to the list. That's the thing. You start doing these races and you have a list and you're like, oh, yeah. There's easier ways to take vacations, right, than to go to a race. But Steve, for you, do you have a favorite?
Cape Cod was nice.
Yeah.
That was the first one that I did. And it was nice because you ran through near the Cranberry Bogs and then you around mile 18 or 19 – you came down the side of a hill, and then there was the Atlantic Ocean to your right, and you ran along the ocean for a little while. But I can't imagine anything is better than Boston. When you're at the marathon, at the Boston Marathon, everybody that's there with you has earned their way, and they come from all over the world. And it's just an amazing feeling to be around that group. And the course is so historic, and it's so wonderful to run up the hills by Boston College, you know, Heartbreak Hill and stuff like that. And then when you see Fenway Park, it gives you a charge, and there's always a baseball game going, although the last time we ran, there was not a baseball game going. And then when you make that right-hand turn and then you make the left onto Boylston, you can hear the roar of the crowd. And, you know, not many of us have been in a stadium or in that kind of atmosphere as just regular people. But there's a lot of screaming going on, and there's a lot of fans lining Boylston Street, and it's just an incredible feeling to go across the finish line.
I got some chills just thinking about it right now.
It really is. And so if you haven't done it and you're a runner, it really is worth the attempt to try to get there.
I thought you guys would appreciate this, and I know, Scott, you've done Wine Glass before.
Yep.
Was it Wine Glass this year, and they had Meb Kofleski there, who I think he's just cool, such an inspiration. So he was at the start, and he said a few words, but it was raining, of course. I can't seem to do a race without it raining. And I was like, okay, cool, you know, and then got to the finish line, and he was there, and he greeted every runner that came across, and he'd just give you a fist bump or a high five. And I didn't realize until I was like I came through the chute by myself, and like, there's Meb, and you get like this 3-second interaction with him and he was like, oh, you look good. And it was just like, whoa, Meb is here. Like that was a really cool recent memory for me. I just thought, wow, that you don't get that in other sports, yeah. Right?
And you really should be tooting your own horn about doing 2 marathons in back-to-back weekends. That's something I could never accomplish.
It was a double-edged sword. I'm toying with the idea of, you know, maybe do I do a 50K?
Mm-hmm.
Just see what the next thing is. So I was like, maybe if I do these back-to-backs, and it went really well, but it was tough. It was really tough, but I did enjoy it. It was a lot of work though. Holy cow.
Yeah.
But I've done the same thing you did where I had a fall race and I wasn't happy. So I found another one and I thought, okay, if I could do that, could I do it 7 days apart? And I did, but the second one, well, I shouldn't say I always get rain because I went to Chicago for the second one and it was about 80, 85 degrees and we just got cooked. But Chicago was a great one too. I'd highly recommend that. So favorite local race that you guys like to do? I mean, everyone loves Pit Run most of the time, except when you're running up the hill. But do you have a favorite local race?
I don't know if it counts as local, but I love doing the Boilermaker.
Yeah, I think it's
a great experience. My favorite part is the amount of people that lined the entire course cheering for you.
Yeah.
And really, it's a big, happy, family, party-like experience the entire race.
Love Boilermaker. Steve, for
you? I like the Boilermaker, too. But yeah. The Pit Run, I have a special spot in my heart because a lot of people line the race course there, and I know a lot of them. So that makes it even better. And I know more of the competitors that are in the race. I also like the course because if you ever run the Pit Run, if you do the 10K, it gets easier. Once you hit the halfway point, actually a little bit beyond the halfway point, when you get to the top of the hill by Hunt Union, it's all downhill from there, and then it flattens out, and if you're ready for the flatter part, it's one of those races where if you put the work in the first half, the second half rewards you. And so I really like it for a lot of those reasons. But more importantly, it's the local people that are there lining the streets and giving us support. It's really nice. And it's for a real good cause, too.
And it's been really neat to see recently, to see a guy like Mike Hamilton win it, a local. You know, for years, dominated by a lot of out-of-town runners from especially New York City. But to see a guy like Mike do it. And, you know, Scott, I know you work with him.
Yep.
I mean, talk about his training.
He's an interesting guy. And I will tell you this about when he won the Pit Run. He told me it will probably go down as one of his happiest memories in his life because he absolutely loves that race.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was able to win it, he was just on cloud nine.
So, I mean, I remember I was at Wine Glass and we were in the car driving home and I'm like, well, let's check the results. And we pulled up and he had won. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is so cool. It felt like we all won, you know, because, I mean, I see you guys at races and Wayne and Mike and all these guys, you know, and I just recently started training with Rob Monroe. Funny that you brought him up, but he's got a nice little group of local guys, Tom Slicer, that he kind of works with. Nick Arnecki has been really good to me recently, and I want to have him on here, but it just felt like we all won that day. I thought that was really cool. But anything else running wise? I mean,
well, Rob has a good race that I want to promote.
Oh yeah,
for the summer, he does a half marathon in Stamford. It ends up in Stamford and it goes along the old railroad track, and that's a beautiful race because it's shady most of the way, and Rob does a really good job with that. So I want to kind of put a plug in for Rob.
I was doing one of the road crossings this year, and you were running along, Scott, and It was a great race, right? I mean,
it's a fun race. And I think it's a trail race, so it's just something different. And it's, if you're a runner, sometimes things get a little stale race-wise and you want to change things up a little bit. And that's the perfect race to do it. And with me, it's a really flat course. And I'm not great with hills, so I really like that course because it is so flat.
Rob had me run over there a bunch this summer, and I really liked it. It was a lot of fun. So, well, if you guys are ready for the hard-hitting final question here, we'll get right to it. But, Steve, we'll start with you. Favorite local place to eat?
Oh, that's a tough question.
Yeah, I know. It's hard.
It depends on the food you're looking for.
Very true.
I need a little time to think about that, so I'm going to use my age privilege on that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Pass this to Scott.
Oh, that's easy. A couple of years ago, a buddy of mine and his cousin opened up a small microbrew. It's the Muddy River, the brewery, and they always have, well, not always, but every once in a while they have a taco truck, Ty's Taqueria, come, and anytime they come, I am there. I am buying multiple meals worth of tacos, and I'm eating every little bit of it.
That's all. I was there this summer, and they had a food truck, but I think it was something different. I think it was pulled pork and stuff. They
filter random ones through. I always check to see where Ty's is in terms of their schedule.
That's,
and I believe they're out of Delhi.
I'll have to check that out. I like going there, though. It's a great spot. So have we given you enough time?
Well, I love Italian food, and Joe and Vinny's in Sydney is fantastic.
That's very true.
I always try to eat there whenever I'm in town. The wings are fantastic, too. In Oneonta, it's a flat-footed Thai. Between Sal's and Tino's. Both the owners are real kind gentlemen, and they're good to talk to. They both put out real good meals, and so I'm going to stick with our local pizza places, those three places.
Scott, I do have one more question for you. I've always been amazed. You and Mike seem to love shorts and sandals for as long as the weather will permit.
Yes.
Coaching-wise. Yep. You don't get cold? How do you do it?
It's part mental, part that we're both just kind of crazy. And I think it's on, like, the mental level. It's good for our athletes and, like, spring track when it's cold out to see us with shorts on. That way they can't complain about it being cold or anything like that. I think it also kind of psychs out some of the other coaches a little bit.
Psychs me out. I mean, I see you guys and I'm freezing and I'm like,
it's our standard issue uniform at Unitigo. Shorts, sandals, whether it's 70 degrees or 30.
It's crazy.
Jeff Matthews also does that too.
Yeah.
I don't know if you realize that, but I always watch Jeff in the football games at night.
He doesn't get cold.
And he doesn't get cold either. So
I don't
know. It's not a unique thing.
No.
But I wouldn't do it.
No. Although I got to give you credit. That day it was raining and stuff. I mean, you just had a t-shirt on, I think. At the soccer game this year.
And I'm Tri-Valley like, Championship.
I had a jacket and all that. And I'm like, how is he not freezing? But I guess you were just in the moment.
I was wet anyway, so.
Well, guys, thank you for coming in. This was great. I think there's a ton more we could talk about. I feel like I have more questions, but we'll have to do a round two. And I think we'll see what the future holds. But thank you for coming in.
And thanks for all your coverage of local sports. I know my players really appreciate everything that you do for them. So I want to thank you for them.
Yep. Every tweet that you mention the kids makes their day.
It's crazy how it's taken on a life of its own. I never intended it to be. I guess, you know, you want to give kids credit, obviously, but it just, to see what it's grown into, it's really kind of a cool thing.
But also, when you do games on the radio, you're a positive voice for all the kids. And I think we need more positive voices out there in the media. So thank you very much.
Yeah. No, it's I'm just so lucky. I mean, the schools around here are great. The coaches are great. The kids are great. There's so much to be positive about. I don't ever even think about being negative on the radio because it's like, this is fun for everybody. So, and we have a lot of good teams. It's easy to talk a lot of positive things about them, that's for sure. So, well, thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, this will wrap up episode 154 today, again with Steve and Scott Hornung, father and son duo, coaching in the Tri-Valley, and great history as well. So check back in the archives. A lot of names that we've talked about today. We've had them here in the studio, so go back and check those out anytime, and we'll see you again soon on the Nate Lowe Podcast.
You've been listening to the Nate Lull Podcast. Download each new episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.